You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahiahi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea toko ingoa.
Ko Sophia toko ingoa, no mai haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. Kia ora mea, how's your week been?
It's been really good. I've had like so many swims.
Oh my god, yeah. I'm so jealous. It was UV9 the other day and sat in the library for like 12 hours and it actually felt criminal.
Yeah, I'm so sorry to say, but I was sunbathing on a beach.
It's okay, that'll be me next week. It's fine.
I feel like it really fast tracked to summer.
It really did. Oh, I'm so here for it.
It's so wonderful.
I love it. And we have a lovely show today, Maya. What have you got?
Yeah, I caught up with artist Timothy Webby about his current work in chemistry, which is on at Coastal Signs. Soph, what have you got?
I caught up with co-editor Luke Wood about the revival of the graphic design journal, The National Grid, after 13 years since its last issue.
He aha ofakara, we would love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patsahi mai. You can text us on 5395. Or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also, after the show, koa e ware ware e ahea na koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō hei pakihere roki roki maronga i te pai tuku tuku o Irirangi Pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Oh, that's a good art!
Timothy Webby is a Tamaki-based multidisciplinary artist, primarily working within photography. In his current exhibition, Chemistry, on at Coastal Signs, Webby presents works alongside artist Emma McIntyre, in which Webby showcases a body of silver gelatin prints, capturing these intimate moments that offer a glimpse into a kind of beauty. Webby utilizes a method of hand-coloring the silver gelatin prints, creating this uniquely beautiful image that pulls the image both back into itself as well as away from itself and into a painterly like abstraction, inserting sweeping movements of colour and texture into the captured image, offering moments of connection between Webby and McIntyre's respective practices, moments of linkage, response and chemistry. I caught up with Timothy Webby about the show and overall practice. Would you like to start off by introducing yourself and your overall practice a little bit?
Kia ora, my name's Timothy Webby. I'm an artist born in Auckland and I still live in Auckland, and I currently work in photography, but I didn't always. People be liking the photography more, so I stick with it.
Sweet. And within your current exhibition, Chemistry at Coastal Signs, you show a series of silver gelatin prints alongside works by artist Emma McIntyre. I'd like to start this conversation off by speaking a bit to how the specific body of work gained its momentum. Did this series come off the back of another project or kind of find its footing with something new?
Well, it's not a project with a really obvious conceptual starting point. Mm. It's more works that I've made that we chose for the exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to ask the curator, really, but the body of work, they're all silver gelatin prints, so 35mm film, and then they're starting off black and white, but they're being coloured. But you've got some stage photos in there as well as candid photographs.
Yeah.
It is quite mixed.
Yeah.
I'm feeling like it's quite mixed.
Yeah. Did they all come from like a range of different projects like over the years or like one past project?
A range. Like I would say that they're individual ideas really. Like you've got the nude shoot of the female nude. That's just an idea where I thought, God, I'd love to photograph a female nude.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like I talked to a friend who agreed that she would like pose, and then so that was just its own little thing.
So they all speak to individual projects with their own kind of encompassing or wider theme or per se.
Yeah, I feel like it is very mixed, but that's correct. Yeah, it's very mixed, but it's all my Tim Webby sort of like brush of sort of colourful sadness, but yeah. So they're not one specific project, but I do think that the way I approach taking photos is got something to do with New Zealand Gothic, but broader than that, probably like just fantasies and settings that I find appealing. And like often I think that starts with like basically a cliche, or like it doesn't come to me as a cliche, but I do find that the cliches, like that you'll see there is an abandoned house photo that she's got in the office, like that's a cliche to me. But not to be pretentious, but it makes me think of the way that jazz musicians, like you start with a standard and you work from that, and it's more about the enjoyment than it is about doing something different figuratively. Like I'm not trying to say something specific, but I would say that it's all quite sort of slightly alternative culture as well. Like not crazy, but like a little bit, like there's drugs, there's nudity. I don't want the work to be super alternative, but I do think that my lifestyle might be slightly as an artist, and I think that's the special spice and the special sauce.
Yeah, and it kind of finds its way in, creeps into your artistic, your project. How does it feel? Because they didn't start off as this one project, and Sarah kind of curated them and brought them into this space. Now seeing them in that room all together, change the way you look at them, or maybe form connections that you maybe wouldn't have seen in that work before, if that makes sense?
Yeah, well, it did worry me a bit in terms of like being in not a solo show where it's not exactly just one project, because it kind of makes you feel like a bit of a phony, I feel, because you just got these things and they're not necessarily about something specific. But there's a little curiosity thing. I think there's a weird, if I could say, like exoticism thing about like animals and people and places and little curiosities and something there.
Yeah, lovely. And I'd like to switch a little bit to the creative process itself. These are silver gelatin prints. How did you get into this quite tedious project? And do you want to speak a little bit to the process itself?
Yeah, so I used to try and paint. I think I'm quite fussy. When I became a high school teacher, also super difficult to do painting around that. Even though I'm a painting teacher, difficult to find the time in this space, I think.
Maybe because it's now associated with, I don't know, you're already putting that energy into that other space.
Work. And like, photography was easy to just pop in and do a little something, develop a film or do a shoot or print one photo. Like, it's just kind of, and it also, it's appealing, like. So I also have tried to use digital photography and colour photography without much. People are not loving it. I think the process of, like, shooting 35mm film, ending up with a negative, printing a contact sheet, seeing which ones you like, printing the ones that you like small, and then gradually working bigger, it just literally makes you make, like, art photography, because, like, otherwise it's could be something else. It could be, it could have another purpose. But I guess it makes you just think, what is art photography? What are the subjects of art photography? And I think, that vintage process, like, it just makes you good at art somehow. Like, because,
Yeah, also, I don't know if this is right, but maybe since photographs are, like, I don't know, everyone's got a phone, everyone's got, do you know what I mean? Like, that digital photography is maybe a lot more, like, widely available and used. So it's, like, by pulling it back to those kind of more analog processes that is, like, inherently got that more, like, artistic linkage. People are really interested in that.
I mean, yeah, and print it out. Like, if you were gonna print out a photo from your phone, it's already like, well, what one do you print out? And then it's like, you could do your family members, but if you're making art, the audience doesn't know the person. So I don't really photograph people much, like, for that reason, because I don't like, it doesn't feel decorative to me, that thing of, like, maybe I know the person, maybe you don't. Like, I don't really like that, but...
Yeah. And some of the photographs you've already kind of spoken about a little bit utilize the incorporation of colour, which from my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is quite unusual for silver gelatin prints. But this use of colour offers this really uniquely beautiful layered and almost textural elements to the prints themselves, both bringing the image back into itself, but like also into a kind of abstraction. Do you want to speak a bit to this use of colour?
I like the way you said that. Because it is like this inside-out way of making the subject of the picture what it's meant to be. But it's inside-out because first it's black and white. And I do think choosing things that look good in black and white first is a process in itself. Like, a lot of... like, I'd love to be photographing native bush, but in black and white is quite... It's tough. It kind of looks like a mess. And it's also not green, which is the main thing.
Yeah.
So first going black and white and then bringing it back... I don't know, it just feels like you're really getting to the essential source of what the subject can be as a print. I don't know, in an inside-out way.
Yeah, it's quite, because we're so used to seeing, like, images in colour all the time, and then, yeah, through that process, you're removing it from its, like, context or maybe its thing, and then, then bringing it back with the colour, bringing it closer to its original form, but then also like not like it's also like pulling it in the other direction. Because I'm not that familiar with photography. How do you apply the color?
It's called the Colorvia coloring kit. It is very rare. Like, I don't think it's made anymore. I found it at a high school I work at, my Takari college.
Yeah.
And it's real beautiful. So you got dyes, which it's basically like diluting raro, making raro, like you just dilute it. So there's dyes which dye the paper, and then there's toners which tone the black image.
Okay.
So the toners are quite vicious chemicals like bleaches and things.
Mm.
And I will run out eventually. And I don't know what.
Yeah, so you colour the paper first without the image on it?
No. You print the picture and then you can paint this dye on, or you can submerse it in dye, or tone it. I think you have to do it the other way around. I think it's toning and then dyeing.
Yeah,
or whatever. But
paintbrush?
Yep, paintbrush. Masking fluid. Like, I think the trick that I love is like you put down masking fluid on the areas that you don't want coloured, and then just like submerse it, and then you get this like really strong layer of colour, but then it's not in the areas you want. And you can splatter on the masking fluid, or you can paint it specifically, or.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So quite painterly and quite...
Can be.
Maybe a bit like a lack of control in some sense. Quite,
And limited, I feel. I like the limitations are that's where the creative part is, I think, in a way. Because then you don't have too many options. And that actually is helpful.
Yeah, sometimes you need limitations to really kind of to push against or to...
Get an idea.
Yeah, like. And speaking about this kind of colour painterly, the thing that's happening, it speaks so well to Emma's paintings and drawings on the opposite side of the wall. I was going to ask if you kind of made it in response to Emma's paintings, but have yet found out that this project wasn't. But I don't know, do you maybe in retrospect, can you see that kind of relation and that bouncing between that painterly kind of approach?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I actually did think about that. There's a yellow canary one where it's like a print of a canary cage. And then I've used masking fluid and splatters, and then but when I printed the photo, I had this like netting down, which was cage-like. And I was thinking about Emma McIntyre's paintings there, because I think it's this thing of like, you do one thing and then you kind of fix it or do another thing, and then a problem might show up, and then your answer to that problem, like if it's a bit cold, maybe it needs a little bit of orange, or you know what I mean? Like just your answers and fixes to the issues are actually what makes a nice like outcome.
Yeah.
And maybe there's a similarity there with her work where she's just, each painting is a thing of its own. She's working on like not a surface level, but like a visual level of like, let's add this, let's add this, when do you stop, what happens if I overlap, what happens if I keep things separate, that sort of thing, just sort of simple stuff, those caveman stuff.
No, I think they work so lovely in the space together, and really there's a beautiful bouncing off of colours and also forms, I feel like, kind of. And also maybe your work maybe brings out certain imagery in her. You know, when things are placed maybe in relation, you kind of notice things that you maybe wouldn't yeah, and maybe it brings your work more into a place of abstraction by having them in relation to hers. I think it's a really, really lovely pairing. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to touch on the installation of your works. They roughly follow the straight line across the large back wall of the gallery, but not quite. There's these really beautiful moments of disruption, variations to the straight line. There's also this variation within the presentation of each print, some framed, others bound to the wall with delicate nails, and some holding on by the means of little clips. Do you want to speak a little bit to this choice of install and this kind of disruption to the straight line and kind of means of presentation?
Yeah, I think this system is vaguely that we've framed some, and choosing which ones to frame wasn't totally obvious. It's not about which ones we're going to sell, because that we want to sell the ones that are unframed. I think it's maybe the ones that are, to me, it's like the ones a bit more monumental or something, and like less experimental.
Yeah.
And so then I think the install is like we've kind of put the framed ones up, and then we've included pinned and clipped ones around them in sort of clusters. And sometimes you've even got a duplicate. Like you might have a framed one that's coloured and then a duplicate that's not. The framing thing is a trauma to me with exhibiting photographs.
Yeah.
Because it's too sad. Like, it's just wildly expensive, particularly when they get large. And it puts pressure, I feel like. This is awkward, but like, I feel like it puts pressure on the relationship between you and the gallerist. Maybe I'm overconscious about that. But then if you've got a gallery that was happy with you clipping a picture or being sensitive to the way that you actually present the work, then it feels fine. Like I feel like Coastal Signs, the way that she received my work was so lovely. Like she was, it was protected with the clips, but it was still natural to the way that I just hang them in my bedroom like that as I make them. I clip them and pin them and things.
And this kind of, was there a consideration for not the full straight line?
Yeah, I think each body of work has a different level of preppiness or grunginess, and so when you're installing, you've got to be sensitive to that. But you sometimes want the works to speak together to each other. Sometimes you don't. You can see pretty quickly, I think, when things don't go well together or when it becomes like bumpy, like when it's like there's too much going on in a series. But when it's right, they bring each other out well. There's like a fishy, watery thing that seemed to come out in my work, and then also kind of in Emma's a bit. And that's why I think we put the water lilies next to her blue painting.
And lastly, what are your hopes for viewers as they engage with this body of work?
I just want to make art that's not boring, and I also want it to not just be for people that are interested in art.
Yeah.
I'm a person who's interested in art. The art needs to be, like, for fun and for looking at. And so sometimes I want it to be, like, shocking or, just out of interest. But I always want it to be beautiful, and I think it is hard when you think, what is the thing that I really think of as beautiful in this world? It's actually a hard thing to answer.
Yeah.
Something that's untethered to anything practical that you care about, and something that you could share with others, something that you think is beautiful but that other people also think is beautiful. When you find your little niche of what that is, it's like fun to go deeper and deeper into that. And I want to go deeper into that.
Yes, wonderful. Anything else you wanted to add?
I would like to plug my other show. It's a solo show at Laurie Payne Gallery in Hamilton. It's a very special show to me. I've used my granddad's photos that he took in 1940 around. It's about 12 photographs and some sculptures, I think. Have a look at that if you're in Hamilton or going down south.
That was Timothy Webby speaking to me about his work in chemistry, which also includes work by Emma McIntyre, and is on at Coastal Signs until the 29th of November.
What's it all for?
Various artists.
We've now got a little song for you. I've been informed by myself that it's the song. This is Genius of Love by Tom Tom Club.
Thank you.
Where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no hat, no play summer. So it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Yes, I am the rhythm selection. Every Monday night from 9 till 11, Dobby and the selectors play the full range of ghetto sound. Yeah, man, from rock steady to roots reggae, bebop sound to hip hop, dub style true to the latest dancehall vibes. Yeah, man, the rhythm selection. Boy, the rhythm selection. Why? The rhythm selection. Boy, from 9 to 11 and 95 FM. Dobby Dam Gay Selectors, the rhythm selection.
Ah, guys, he finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God! It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
The National Grid is a graphic design journal based in Aotearoa. Having started publishing in 2006 with the editorship of Jonty Valentine and Luke Wood, The National Grid became recognised for its dedication to graphic design research, practices and features from local and international practitioners and theorists, having a unique, expansive view of graphic design that embraced its social and cultural impact as a whole. After the project came to a halt in 2012, Luke Wood, Matthew Galloway and Katie Kerr have now revived the journal for 2025, with issue 9 set to launch on Monday. Not quite a magazine and not quite an academic journal, The National Grid seeks to walk the line between professional practice and academia and art and design, with its 9th issue taking on the current climate of design education, looking back into Pacifica publishing histories and sketching out diagrams for possible futures. I had a kōrero with co-editor and co-founder Luke Wood about its beginnings and where The National Grid is now.
The National Grid it was an idea we had a little bit before that. So I set it up with a guy called Jonty Valentine, who was teaching graphic design back then at AUT. And I had just started teaching at Canterbury University. And we'd both recently done our masters. Jonty had done his over at Yale and I'd done mine at RMIT. And we were both interested in writing about design. And at the time, there was only really one place to do that in New Zealand. It was a magazine called Pro Design. And it doesn't exist anymore, but it was a very kind of work-focused kind of trade journal. And both of us did actually write for that a couple of times, but didn't kind of really like it. It wasn't the kind of stuff we wanted to write about. Both Jonty and I had a background in art publishing, kind of all throughout the 90s, really, the 1990s. We both worked as graphic designers in museums and for art galleries and stuff like that. So, yeah, we had this kind of pretty deep background in art publishing. And because of that, we had been, you know, kind of reading lots of art writing. And so we were aware that art got written about in a way that design didn't. Which, you know, in hindsight, I would say is that it's sort of more, it's normal for art to be talked about as part of kind of culture and society, whereas design, especially back then and in the kind of platforms that existed, was really only being talked about as a sort of tool for business, which I guess that's what kind of connected Jonty and I. We didn't really care about design as a tool for business. That just wasn't interesting to us. Like, we understand that's what most design or designers work for, but we just didn't care about that. And so, yeah, we wanted to kind of write about design in a way that was more like kind of friends of ours who were art writers. And so the only way really we could see to do that was to start a publication. And I guess because we were designers, we knew a lot about publishing. So it felt easy enough to kind of set that up. But we had a lot of anxiety at the start about being sort of charlatans or dilettantes, like we weren't writers. And so it was a massive learning curve. And so it ran from 2000 and I think the first one was published in, was it 2005? Yeah, right. And then so the last one we did in that first run was in 2012, and that was issue number 8. I mean, I guess the next question would be, why did we stop? It came to a kind of slow grinding end. So one of the weird things about The National Grid was because it was all about New Zealand design, but we never really sold many in New Zealand. We sold them, most of them, overseas. And we had a pretty good distribution network going of like lots of little independent bookstores in just kind of major cities around the world, which was great. So we were selling them. But back then, even though that doesn't feel like that long ago to me, it's kind of, it pays to remember that PayPal existed, but people didn't really trust it massively. And so the bookstores we were dealing with, it was kind of a real pain in the ass for them to have to pay us through like international bank transfers. It was just a lot more complicated. And so some of the shops we sold most copies through to this day have still not paid us. Like, we're owed like $10,000 by a shop in New York and a similar amount from a shop in Amsterdam.
That's
long
nuts.
Since given up on getting. So that was kind of one big problem. And then the other big problem was that we were both academics and the university didn't really like the publication because it wasn't really an academic journal. And that was really important to us that it wasn't an academic journal, because our experience of that is that no one reads academic journals. Other academics, maybe. But we were really interested in The National Grid being a sort of platform between academia and professional practice. And so we sort of stuck to our guns on that, but that meant that we didn't get any support from the universities we worked for. And so that kind of is what kind of just kind of broke our backs in the end. And the fact, you know, it was just two of us doing it, and it's a lot of work.
For sure. Yeah, you spoke there, of course, about, you know, why you guys stopped. But we're here, of course, today because after 13 years since your last issue in 2012, you're reviving the National Grid, now with a team of three of you editing it, yourself, Matthew Galloway and Katie Kerr, as well as an external editorial board of eight others, a much larger team to hopefully maybe fix a couple of those issues there. But what was kind of the impetus to revive it for 2020?
Well, actually, so just after lockdown, I had started thinking a lot about trying to set up a design research group. I think lockdown was important because I, you know, like we all did, kind of noticed the kind of burgeoning culture wars that were happening. And I was kind of really interested in the roles design kind of played or didn't play in that kind of new world that seemed to emerge from that whole COVID thing. Part of this also is the fact that I work down here at Canterbury University. Christchurch feels kind of isolated. You know, it's not, there's not a big design community here. And I also live way out of town, so I'm not super connected. And I sort of knew that I missed how connected we were when we were doing the National Grid. Like, we had contributors from all over New Zealand, but also we met a lot of people internationally. And I sort of had come to miss that, and then was also kind of interested in design in a sort of more, I guess, political way because of what was happening after 2020. And so I had this idea to put together a design research kind of group or network or something that would sort of help connect. Probably at the time I was just thinking it's design academics from different universities around New Zealand, polytechs, and that anyone kind of engaging in design research could be part of this group. So I reached out to a bunch of people, and that kind of turned into fairly regular conversations between myself and Jonty, but also Matt and Katie. And we just started talking quite a lot about, you know, getting this network thing set up. I should say maybe that Matt and Katie are both ex-postgraduate students of mine. So I kind of know them through that. And like, Matt's gone on to become kind of an artist slash design researcher, and Katie has a very kind of self-motivated practice as well. So both of them sit a bit outside of the kind of world of successful commercial design. But yeah, so we were talking a lot, and we were talking about what this group might do. And there was kind of a couple of things. One, we wanted to kind of advocate for design research projects to be exhibited and like museums and galleries and stuff. But also we thought it'd be useful to kind of publish. Basically, we wanted to make design research visible. And then, of course, the more we talked about this, the publishing part especially, Katie and Matt kind of just kept suggesting that it sounded like we were just talking about the National Grid again. And it was really them, it was their idea really to start this again. Jonty and I were both a bit skeptical, and I remained quite skeptical up until I think we actually started work on this issue. Yeah, so that's really how it rolled around. Jonty sort of was involved at the start of the issue, but sort of had to pull out for various reasons. So he hasn't been involved as an editor in this issue, but hopefully he will be again in the future. Feels really different now. Like, the first thing being that, you know, I was saying like the whole getting paid thing was difficult last time. It's, I know from other, I've done kind of publication projects since, you know, proven that it's much easier to get paid now. So I think that's a big change. I think also having more people on board is a big change. And then also the idea to set up an editorial board so that it will work as an academic journal. And we're going to be kind of a hybrid publication in that sense. So if people want the kind of peer review aspect that makes it an academic journal, we can kind of engage the editorial board for that. But also we still want to be able to publish different kinds of writing as well. So I guess, yeah, those are the kind of main differences. And also I guess what Katie and Matt have brought to it makes it feel quite different. Jonty and I are quite similar, I guess. And I think the first kind of run of eight issues will probably feel quite different to this next run for various reasons. I think Jonty and I tend to be kind of cynical old men. And I think Katie and Matt bring optimism to it. Yeah. So maybe it's a better mix now of kind of criticality and optimism.
Yeah. No, nice. You mentioned at the beginning there that, like, you felt that when starting the National Grid that there was kind of a gap in the kind of design environment and publication environment in New Zealand. And that's been a big part of what the National Grid was, of course. Kind of bringing it back now, was there something about the current graphic design environment or state of the industry in Aotearoa that made it feel like the right time to bring it back? Do you feel like there's still a gap to fill?
Yeah, although I don't think it's got really anything to do with the industry. I think in the first years, Jonty and I did think part of our job was to be critical of the design industry. I don't think that anymore. I just don't. I mean, I think the design industry does what it does, and that's, you know, largely fine. It's just that's not really what we're interested in. We're much more interested in the roles design plays in sort of politics and culture. Like, that's what's interesting to us. And being able to kind of look at and think about and analyse those things through a critical lens. Yeah, does that kind of answer the question?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You also kind of talked about a little bit earlier how, it, you know, the National Grid was not quite an academic journal, but also not quite a magazine, and kind of sitting somewhere in the middle there. You also kind of talked a little bit about some of the differences that it might have going into this kind of new era of it. How have your kind of ambitions with the publication changed in this kind of next era of life for it?
That's a good question. I think one of the big changes, well, it's not a big change. Jonty and I were always, I guess in the first stages, we were very kind of interested in unpacking a design history that existed but wasn't visible. And so this idea that there was an underground design history out there, maybe not so much underground, but just like not documented. Mm. We were quite interested in looking at really normal things. Like Jonty wrote quite a lot about the old scoreboard signs from Carlaw Park, which he managed to kind of get his hands on. Yeah, and I in the very first issue, I interviewed a young Māori designer who ran a record label in Wellington and was doing really cool posters that I'd see around the streets. And I was sort of really aware that stuff we were interested in and we thought was really cool, that was just not being touched by any of the other kind of publications or websites or whatever were around, which at the time was mostly just DINS, the Design Institute of New Zealand, and they sort of published Pro Design. And it's the Best Design Awards that was around. And that, so any, you know, if you wanted to go looking for New Zealand design, that's where you kind of looked. Yeah, and so we were very aware of that we were looking at different stuff, maybe more everyday kind of mundane stuff, but wanting to kind of talk about that in an elevated way. Mm. But then maybe the difference now is that I think partly just because of the timing, I think it's more overtly political now. I think, you know, just because of what's been happening, we have gone quite hard to, you know, kind of draw in Indigenous content, especially in a sense like going looking for that stuff. There's a lot more of it around now. We were kind of interested in that in that first kind of run of issues, but it was really hard to find. It was hard to find anyone who wanted to write about it, whereas it feels very different now. Like that's a bigger conversation. And a conversation that's being had in design schools all over the country. And actually, I think that's another big change too. A lot more people are doing postgraduate design study, whereas back when we were doing the early issues, that wasn't such a thing. And so I think now maybe there's, well, hopefully, we'll find out when we release this issue, but I think there's more interest in it, in kind of reading this kind of stuff, but also people interested in kind of writing about this kind of stuff.
For sure, yeah. For sure. It definitely ties in well to my next question. I want to talk a little bit about this upcoming issue, issue 9. There's some really interesting pieces in it that definitely tie into those kind of goals and refocusing that you've just been talking about there. A feature on Mana magazine, an interview with Extended Whānau on their Together for Te Tiriti Tohu, and a conversation between yourself and international design studies expert Professor Cameron Tonkinwise on design studies in crisis, to name a few that stood out to me, I guess, in that kind of change. Talk me through some of the people who have worked on this issue and the content in it.
So, yeah, we've got a bit of different stuff. I guess kind of in terms of what we were just talking about then, sort of bringing more Indigenous stuff in, the very first kind of major article in this issue is called Design Landscapes, A Brief History of the Futures Cone. And that basically takes the form of a conversation between Matt Galloway, one of our editors, and Hana Pera Aoki. Basically, it's Matt's PhD. Matt did his PhD on this thing called the Futures Cone. I guess I should explain that. The Futures Cone is this kind of diagram, essentially, that kind of suggests different possible ways we could think about the future, and that there are kind of preferable, plausible, and probable futures, and they all sort of span out from this cone. And it's been a kind of very popular sort of diagrammatic device in things like speculative design. So types of design that imagine, that exist to imagine different futures. So Matt did his PhD on that, and then sort of discovered that there were kind of crossovers with sort of types of diagramming that Hana was doing or looking at that relate quite specifically to sort of tikanga and mātauranga Māori. So that's kind of the first big one. The next one is kind of a funny one, actually. It's by a guy who teaches with me down here, Luke Shaw, and he's recently become a stamp collector.
Oh.
Luke Shaw is also an artist, though, and his work revolves around quite often sort of installations to do with sound and the transmitting of sound. And he sort of through another project he did down here about clock towers, he kind of got really interested in lighthouses and then discovered that the New Zealand Government Life Agency did a whole series of stamps for quite a few years, actually, that had different lighthouses from around New Zealand on them. So that's kind of about that. Then we've got a bunch of posters by an Auckland-based designer called Sheehan Hurry, who was actually a student of mine at AUT years ago, a student of mine and Jonty's at AUT, and having him on board's great because he's always been a big fan and a supporter and just a generally encouraging kind of guy. He's also designed the cover for this issue. Then there's my interview with Cameron, and that's really about, it's called Design Studies in Crisis. I think lots of studies are in crisis. That one's really about my sort of anxiety about being an academic in a time of kind of extreme neoliberalism. Cameron has worked all over the world. Like he set up the transition design PhD at Carnegie Mellon and he came back to University of Sydney, University of Technology Sydney, yeah, UTS is where he is, to kind of work there. And then now they're going through these kind of massive upheavals as well. I guess basically the gist of that is that I'm kind of looking at wanting design to still be kind of a form of liberal art study rather than just what it's quite quickly becoming, which is just sort of super large scale schools where students just go to learn the latest software, kind of hard technical skills, which are going to be taken over by AI anyway, right? You know, I think education in general is in at a point of crisis. We really need to think about what education is in the face of AI and also in the face of what we see happening around the world, like fascism taking hold in the United States, you know, and plenty of sympathy for that here too, sadly. Yeah, so that's kind of that piece. The next one, the one you mentioned about the Mana newspaper one, that's actually based on an exhibition that was held at the Auckland Museum. And so it's basically the curators of that produced that article for us, and we've kind of reproduced pages from Mana. Mana's super interesting. I mean, it only existed for a couple of years, but it was a kind of Maori and Pacifica newspaper printed in Auckland. Super interesting for multiple reasons, like A, politically, and Indigenous people trying to kind of claim agency through publishing, like that's super interesting. But also as a designer, one of the really interesting things about it is that it's published in different languages. So there's some really kind of interesting things that happen there with that. The next one is by someone who was from New Zealand but now lives in, I think Switzerland or France? France, Nell May, and she has just recently done her master's at, I think, ICAL, and it's basically for her master's she's generated typefaces, designed typefaces specifically to be seen on like dark backgrounds on phones. So it's about light, typefaces to be seen with light rather than typefaces printed on things, like, which is why we've always designed typefaces in the past. And she sort of talks a lot about the history of, light on dark typefaces. That's a really interesting piece. And publishing kind of recent, kind of graduate, postgraduate work I think is a really great thing for us to be doing. Mm. The next one is a kind of four-way interview that Katie did with Extended Whānau. And yeah, obviously that's super interesting and super timely. It's about the tohu they designed. That's a really good one. And then we end on a kind of funny little short piece called Language Support, which will be a kind of regular column that we'll have in every issue now, and that will be written by David Benaworth and Warren Olds.
That was co-editor and co-founder of The National Grid, Luke Wood, speaking to me about the graphic design journal's revival and upcoming 9th issue. Issue 9 is available now for pre-order from thenationalgrid.net, and you can also join the editors to celebrate the issue at its launch at Object Space this coming Monday, 10th of November from 5:30 p.m.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists.
Thank you.
It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists.
It's paintings in there.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tamaki Makaurau, as mentioned on the show, Chemistry, an exhibition by Emma McIntyre and Timothy Webby, is on at Coastal Signs until the 29th of November.
Also as mentioned on the show, the National Grid's 9th issue is launching at Object Space this coming Monday, 10th of November from 5:30pm.
Retreat, an exhibition by Georgia Arnold, is currently on at Melanie Roger Gallery until the 29th of November.
Christian Dimmock is showing at Myers Park Cottage until tomorrow before his work is shown with Grace Aotearoa for the Melbourne Art Fair.
Gus Fisher Gallery's group exhibition, What We Choose to Remember, is on until the 13th of December.
Echo, an exhibition by Tarika Sabul, Erica Holm and Naroma Riley, is on at Artspace Aotearoa until the 20th of December. There is also an artist talk from the exhibiting artist tomorrow at 2pm at the gallery. It's a free event, so head along.
Eva Durin's Under the Bridge is on at the Arts House Trust at Pa Homestead until the 18th of January.
Hedia Anderson Mita's Pa Te Huarahi Ki Te Kainga, Finding My Way Home, is on at Tim Melville Gallery until the 15th of November.
Room currently has two exhibitions on view, Stack Rat by Finn Chadwick, Marilyn Jones and Bronte Heron, and Prelude by Tess Walker-Elliott. Both are on until the 29th of November.
And lastly, Louise Bourgeois in Private View is on at Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tamaki. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us on various artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us.
Luke Wood.
And Timothy Webby.
Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com or check out our Instagram, 95bfm various artists, for more.
Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove with Mari. My name is Sophia.
I'm Maya.
And that was various artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95bfm. FM. Ka kite.
Ka kite. Enjoy the sun.
Yes.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.